This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tijeras, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking with veteran, author, and the museum writer-in-residence, Paul Zobrod. Actually, writer-in-residence emeritus, Paul Zobrod. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Circe. How are you?
I'm doing well. I wanted to tell our listeners that we're doing this phone interview, even though we're in the same state, in the same geographical region, we're social distancing due to the coronavirus. So I just thought we'd have a little conversation and, you know, spend some time together. I wanted to start off by saying that you spent a few years as our museum writer-in-residence, and you solicited stories for several anthologies and led book discussions, and you were great at it. What was it like for you being the museum writer-in-residence?
Oh, I loved it, Circe. It's a great little museum and a lively place. I really cherish the times that I've spent there.
Well, we enjoyed the discussions because you were so good at facilitating and bringing in historical context to a mixed group of people. And that's what I wanted to talk about next. You worked for years, 30 years as a college professor in Pennsylvania, but also here in the Four Corners region of New Mexico. I think you taught at the Diné College up in Crown Point. You wrote some books about Diné culture. Could you tell us about those?
Yes, I think the major piece of work was my translation, English translation of the Navajo creation story, which is long and complex and involved, and including the research and mastering the language. It took 12 years.
Wow. What's the name of the book?
Diné Bahané. The Navajo Creation Story, published by the University of New Mexico Press, still very much in print. It's gone through 16 printings, and it's now considered more or less the official English version of the Navajo mythic cycle tracing the beginning of the earth.
Wow. What other books have you done on the Diné culture?
Oh, I co-edited a book on Navajo weaving. A Navajo collaborator and I talked to 60 weavers in the Crown Point area and learned that Navajo rugs in many cases are really based on the Navajo mythology. I've also published a number of articles various things, some of them academic, some of them in El Palacio and Navajo or the New Mexico Magazine.
Wow. So I didn't know that you had published so many books and articles. I do know, however, that you were a Korean War era veteran and you were stationed in Japan. You were pretty young when you went. What was it like being in Japan, and how old were you? And
I was drafted right after my 20th birthday in early 1953. I took my basic training as a rifleman, destined to go to Korea, but just as our basic training cycle ended, the armistice was signed, so I was sent to Japan instead. And I spent the second year of my deployment in Tokyo.
What was it like? Had you ever left the United States before then?
Oh, no. I'll tell you what. A young 20-year-old couldn't have asked for a better assignment, a better experience. You know, I wasn't dry behind the ears yet, and there I was not expecting anything like what I experienced, and the most significant thing in retrospect is that I was stationed at Tokyo Quartermaster Depot as the war in what we now call Vietnam was really drawing this country into it. We were working around the clock, sending material to the French who were surrounded at Dien Bien Phu. Little did we know that was the beginning of this country's involvement in what became the Vietnam War.
So, and I think at one point last year, you found out that because of this service, you actually technically are a Vietnam War veteran?
Yes, I'm one of a small number of veterans who are officially veterans both of the Korean War and the Vietnam War.
And it was the same job in two different conflicts a decade apart. That's interesting.
As you know, I've written about this. I remember when we were busy sending material to the French and to American quote unquote advisors stationed in what was in Indochina. The major, our commanding officer, called us around and said, "Boys, this country is getting involved in a war that's going to make Korea look like a picnic."
Wow. And he was so right.
I mean, it was an exciting experience. And more than that, as you gain experience and so forth, you learn to look back and things in perspective. It was really, I can say this without fear of being glib or coming up with a cliche, it was an honor to serve the country. I mean, I look back on those 2 years with great pride.
Is that pride what inspired you to write your novel, Battle Songs?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that yesterday, Circe, and getting ready for our discussion. When I was taking basic training, I learned during the last several weeks of training that I was going to be sent to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
The war was still going on. It had devolved into a kind of brush war. But really, to put it bluntly, we were learning how to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And when I found out that I was going to be deployed there, I was frightened.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I took a long walk, and I began to just think about things, reflect, in a way that a 20-year-old is learning how to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
And this really planted a seed in my mind, the question of going to war. You know, I was old enough to live through World War II and remembering that. And that's when I really became fixated on that war. So that, by the time I came out and went to college, I just, out of pure curiosity, I began to research it. And the idea for the novel just, even back then, began to percolate.
So the full title of the novel, which we're going to discuss a little bit more here in a minute, is called Battle Songs. What's the rest of the title?
Battle Songs, A Story of the Korean War in Four Movements.
And it starts off very much like music, which is interesting. Throughout your whole book, there's kind of these, you've broken it into movements. Give our listeners a brief synopsis of the novel.
Well, it's a story of four young inductees who, one of them is from a coal mining town in southwest Pennsylvania where I grew up. It was the environment I grew up in. The other three were from farm families a little bit north of Pittsburgh, and they get together and they bond.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story of the four of them and of their deployment. And only one of them survives. And it's a story of really of how they carry their identities as from coal mining communities and a farm community into the war.
Well, I've read it and I found it fascinating, and especially the you know, just the descriptions that you gave it. I felt like I was in, you know, dripping wet Pittsburgh one cold night as the inductees are leaving town on trains. It your writing is beautiful. You very generously allowed our museum press to sell the book with the proceeds going to the museum, and I wanted to thank you for that. But why did you do that? I mean, you could have sold this novel and kept all the profits for yourself or given it to somebody else. Why did you choose to do it for the museum?
Well, part of the story has to do with the novel itself, seriously, and my own story. You know, I began writing the novel while I was in graduate school, and I never finished it. I gave copies of it to my children, but the idea never left me. You know, the question of why do we fight wars, you know, and why are innocent young men or boys implicated in all this? Well, when we went to war in Iraq, you know, my children knew what I had written so far, and my two children urged me to finish it because the question I was raising then still prevailed. So I finished it then. Well, you know, by that time I'm already an old man, and in order to, you know, I had a publisher for the book, but when you write a book like that, you're supposed to market it yourself, go on tours, and you know, and publicize it and so forth. I just didn't have the appetite for that. Seriously, I'm at an age now where I don't need to get rich. Not to say that I would have gotten rich selling them. But, you know, I finally decided, well, you know, this book isn't going anywhere. I'm not selling many copies. I just thought that I would turn it over to the museum and make it part of the museum's archives and let the museum sell it and get the proceeds. I don't have a lot of money, but this was a good way to support the museum, which I heartily believe in. You know, it's the only museum of its kind in the country, maybe in the world. Bringing up the fact that it's not only the soldiers who fight, but it's families who sacrifice.
Well,
I'll tell you what, at this stage of the game, I'm more interested in getting readers for the book than I am in any kind of money that I can make, you know, at my age. I don't need anything else. I have what I need. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, in the book, there's a great many paragraphs dedicated to the family. You know, the boys' parents, the neighbors, the girlfriends. And so the book is not just the four boys, although it is 90% that. There is, you are absolutely right, when, you know, the mother finds out her son is going to war, she's worried, she's proud, she's terrified. And so I think that the book is fits right into our museum's archives, but it resonates not only with readers who like war books, but also readers who want a good story and are interested in the complex characters.
Well, the thing is that, you know, when you go into the military, especially during wartime, you're not going yourself. You're taking your whole family with you. You're taking your whole community with you, and you're just an extension of that. This is the point I want to make. You know. I'd like to say this too, because in preparation for our discussion, I was going over it again yesterday. And you know, when I read things that I've written a long time ago, when I read my own work, I'm a pretty harsh critic. But I have to say that I read this and I'm happy with it. I consider it the best thing I've written. And for that reason, I mean, it's like you read a good story, and you want others to read it too. And that's the way I feel about that book, especially with the message that it carries. And I just figured, what better place to get the book to circulate than the Museum of the American Military Family?
Well, we definitely do appreciate it, and we hope that some of our listeners will take you up on your pride and read the book. We will post the link to where the book can be bought in the body of our podcast on the website, so people will know that they can get it at lulu.com. So, getting back to Japan, while you were in Japan working at the quartermaster depot, you got really sick, which inspired another story that you wrote, which we've turned into a really wonderful short Christmas story. It's called GI Christmas. Tell us a little bit about the story that inspired you to write the piece, which is now a small book. And we had an exhibit last year around that.
Well, if you remember correctly, I think this was going on 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to keep track of time anymore. I think if I remember correctly, you asked me to write something for the museum for Christmas.
Right.
And you know, that Christmas I spent in Tokyo, really made an impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were working very hard. I mean, we were overworked, and we were under a lot of pressure. And I remember something. When I was taken to the hospital, and I was very sick, nobody, to this day, we don't know exactly what I had, some kind of blood disease. But when I was taken to the hospital, the major, the same major who made that comment to us, a really fine man, one of the probably among adults made as deep an impression on me as any professor I had, even though I was only affiliated with him for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember as we parted company and I was being taken to the hospital, I remember him grumbling that I was a casualty of the Cold War. He had a certain hard-nosed way of looking at the reality that he lived with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, when I found myself in the hospital and I was beginning to recover, I found myself stationed with other veterans, some of whom had been to Korea, and it was, I mean, you asked me to write that story, and that's when I began to feel like I was a veteran. You know, I was a war casualty, as the major put it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my memory started churning up. You know, that's a strong memory for me. It was a great moment in my life, recovering and having that experience and experiencing Christmas Eve and Christmas Day in Tokyo Army Hospital.
Well, what's more extraordinary about that story is that you are Jewish, and the other people that play very prominently in your life, in this story, in this moment of history, are Muslims. And so why don't you give, without giving away the whole story, just tell a little bit about some of the other characters in the story.
Oh, yeah, you know what, I mean, you know, leave it to the army. There was some kind of little glitch, and when I was admitted to the hospital, for some reason, I was admitted to a ward where most of the others were Turks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there I was with all these Turks, and we bonded, and that itself was an experience. The guy I mentioned, Mustafa, that we spent 2 weeks together. We became very close friends. Others, he said.
Yes. So, Paul, why were the Turks in the army hospital?
What'd you say?
I said, why were the Turks in the U.S. Army hospital?
No, because, you know, our greatest allies in the Korean War, people don't realize this, our greatest allies were the Turks. They, after the Americans, there were more Turks involved in, you know, in that United Nations police action, so-called, than any other nationality. The Turks hated the Russians, and they were, you know, they were real comrades in arms. And you talk to some, you know, Korean War veterans who actually served there, and they'll tell you. And Turkey really, they were our strong allies. They were great fighters too, by the way.
So I did some research, and it looked like that there was the hemorrhagic fever that came out of the Korean War, and so it's very possible that your Turkish soldiers had hemorrhagic fever.
Well, most of them that were there had. Mm-hmm. No, and that's for a while. That's what they. But I was never diagnosed with that.
Uh-huh.
No, that was hemorrhagic fever alley. Then the Americans were. A lot of the Americans were there stricken with hemorrhagic fever too. But for some reason, they put me in a ward with Turks, and of course, being Jewish, I had a dark complexion and black hair, and I looked like one of them.
So let's just talk about that for a minute. You know, right now we're having a national discussion across this country about racism and social injustice. And, you know, there's a lot of division and a lot of confusion in this country. Did you see any racism or prejudice
Not in that ambience. Seriously, not in Tokyo Army Hospital. Then there were a couple of Frenchmen. There were Canadians. There were all nationalities. And no. And you know what? People need to pay more attention to this than do. The Army, American military was the first institution to desegregate, to integrate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I took to training with black people, and I wish the military got more credit for this kind of acceptance of what we now call multiculturalism.
Mm.
And of course, you know that my favorite experience during that whole stay was when I had to come to the defense of my Turkish buddies. You know, we were all allowed to go down to the dining hall together, and they tried to serve pork, and the Turks were indignant, and nobody down there could figure out why. And I said, I know why, because I'm Jewish, and we keep kosher. They can't eat. They can't eat pork, you know, and I mean, this is where we really bonded. That's a sterling memory of mine from those early days in my life.
Well, it was a great story, and Battle Songs is a great story too. Are you working on your memoirs? My father's working on his memoirs during this pandemic, and I was wondering if you're doing any writing about your childhood or your family history or possibly military stories. What are you doing?
Well, you know, I sent you not too long ago, I sent you my recollection of the outbreak of World War II. You know, your
right.
Dad and I have talked at some length about that because we're the same generation.
Mm-hmm.
There's that, and what I'm most involved with right now is I'm trying to write a memoir of my experience with the Navajo community.
Mm.
That's my biggest preoccupation. But you know, every once in a while, it's fun to stop what I'm doing and write something for the museum.
Well, we definitely appreciate it. Your stories are wonderful, and you know, we've got a blog called "The Land of Enchantment Goes to War," And it's World War II and Korean veteran stories and family stories. And so we're always excited when you send us a piece. I know you sent us one recently about the VA and the experience of a Korean War veteran going to the VA. And you're very positive about the VA experience.
Oh, you know what? If I can put in a word about that too, Searcy, I wasn't aware until maybe 20 years ago that I was eligible to get my health care at the VA because thanks to my illness, I came out of the service with a disability. Well, the VA hospital, the whole VA healthcare facility in Albuquerque is just a great place. You know, it makes me proud of my identity as a veteran.
Yeah, I know you mentioned that there was an older veteran than you, a World War II veteran, and you and he were talking. And my dad laughs because he's considered World War II occupation. He says there's not many people older than us anymore.
No, we're the old guys, seriously.
Well, we're going to need to wrap it up. And so I wanted to ask if you had anything else to say, if you wanted to talk about anything in the few minutes we have left.
Well, you know what I'd like to put in a word for the museum. And for you, for the effort you and your dad have put into it, for the idea, and I want to urge people to get involved with the museum. If you have a couple bucks to spare, give it to the museum in its effort to find a permanent place in Harris. And to thank you for the work you're doing. More people need to know it. Here's what I like to say.
Okay.
The promise that we realize belong to military families, and if anybody starts asking around, talk to your parents, your grandparents in that generation, or even your great grandparents, and discover that virtually everybody has a near relative, at least one near relative, who served. And I repeat, just about all of us belong to a military family. And it's worthwhile going to the museum, not only to see the displays and the exhibits, but sit down and talk to other people and find out how much we have in common with one another, even though we ourselves may not be military people, may not be veterans.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to stop, and so I just wanted to say that this has been Paul Zobrod, our writer in residence emeritus, and I have been speaking with him. And I thank you very much, Paul, for...
Thank you, seriously, and listen, keep up the good work.
Thank you. The museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We look forward to bringing you more podcasts over the next, forever. And thank you, Paul, once again.
Thank you, Searcy.